Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, this is Rebecca Buchanan, host of New Books Network, New Books and Popular Culture, and today I'm here with Ana Rabinovich-Fox, who is the author of Dressed for Freedom, The Fashionable Politics of American Feminism. So Ana, thanks for being here with me today.
Thank you, and I'm glad to be here.
Could you talk a little bit about how this book came about, how you got interested in American sort of feminism and fashion and writing about it?
Sure. So this book started as my dissertation. And when I was looking for a topic, I knew I wanted to write about feminism and the women's movement. And one of the things that kind of bothered me as someone who always thought about herself as a feminist is the fact that the movement has kind of a bad PR, right? We have all those, I'm not a feminist, but because I like to wear high heels, because I like to wear lipstick. And there is this myth that, you know, if you're a feminist, you can be into fashion, or you're very kind of you're a Birkenstock kind of non-shaving a woman. And I wondered kind of where did this myth came from? And when I started looking, I initially looked at the suffrage movement and kind of early 20th century feminists. And what struck me was how much in the press they got kind of oh, these are such beautiful women. And they themselves were so much into fashion and writing about it. And so I was okay, so where does this come from, right? Why are we always think about feminists as anti-fashion while they clearly weren't? And then when I start to dig in, I was okay, this is a much more complex story to tell and we need to kind of go away from this myth. Because I think it's in the end not very constructive, not to the history, but also not to feminism as a movement itself, because feminism for a long time used fashion as a political tool to their favor. And I think we have a lot to learn, even today from their experiences. So kind of when I got into this project, I kind of okay, so let's unpack this myth and let's see what's really going on here and what's the role of fashion in feminism. So that's basically what got me started.
And you focus, could you talk a little bit before we sort of get into what you looked at, the time frame and the time period? I mean, you also didn't look at everything about fashion. So, right. Was there a reason you chose that sort of 19th century, that focus, or could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So the kind of the beginning of the American movement, at least in the United States, is oftentimes being ascribed to 1848 and the Second Seneca Fall Convention. And by 1850, we have the bloomer costume, which is kind of a major, kind of maybe the first fashion event in the movement that started really as a reform dress, as a political statement for many of the women's rights advocate in the movement. And it was a big fiasco and a huge failure and a great trauma for many of the feminists who came after. So it was really an event, and it kind of like, and that event really set this myth, right, that feminists are anti-fashion. But by the late 19th century, there are new fashions. I mean, the rise of the ready-made industry, which is clothes that are what we, most of us are now, those are the clothes we wear. It's clothes that are being made for us, oftentimes in a mass scale, standardized sizes, not to our own individual body. But with this rise of industry, and because of all kind of technological improvements and technological incentives, right? If you do something on a mass scale, you usually need to simplify patterns. You need to, there are some kind of like considerations that really made it possible for feminists and for other women that not necessarily identified as feminists to use fashion to their own favor and to kind of like in advance ideas of comfort, of utility, of functionality, of freedom that were not, that were in line with kind of like the mainstream trends and not necessarily as opposing to them. And it started kind of like a new chapter in kind of like the relationship between feminism and fashion, which I thought was a good place to start. So I mentioned the bloomer in my introduction, because I think that's kind of like the story that is more known and more kind of like when people think about right, feminism and fashion, they either think about the bloomer or the bra burners of the 1970s. And I was like, okay, but what's happened in between, right? What other images can we claim as feminist images that relates to fashion? So that was kind of like the way I organized the book, that it does move chronologically, but it does focus on those fashionable moments in which women are using fashion to advance those feminist ideas that are in kind of like between those two signpost of like the myth of the ugly feminist that we used to think about.
So you start, right? So your first chapter starts right before, or before we get into sort of our big suffrage movement, right, in the early 1900s. But you look at sort of the Gibson girl and this sort of new look needed to, and it's interesting, a lot of the things you talk about look at also that allow women to be more athletic or move more. So can you talk a little bit about that first chapter and the Gibson girl and what you were sort of were finding and seeing there?
Sure. Yeah. So the Gibson girl is kind of like becoming by the 1890s, the most popular image of kind of like what we now identify as the new woman. And the new woman is kind of like a very amorphic term. It sometimes do refer to activists and suffragists that fought for women's rights, but it really is about a new concept of womanhood and about, it's often white, it's often middle class. And it's about this new reality of women that are entering education, leisure, the workforce, and it is based on an illustration by Charles Dana Gibson. So this is why it's the Gibson girl. There were other girls in the press of those images, but Gibson really become kind of like a success. And it really is becoming kind of like one of the most marketed and commercialized images out there. So like together with, you know, Uncle Sam and Columbia, it really is kind of like one of the most prominent images to circulate at the moment. And what makes it so popular is because he depicts her as this very young woman, right? She's never depicted as a mother. She's never depicted as even a married woman. So it's a single woman, often college age. He often depicts her in kind of like leisurely sports activities. So it's really easy to identify with her kind of like more collegiate image. And she often wears a shirt waist and a skirt, which becomes kind of like the new fashion at the time. That is very much associated both with Americanism. She's becoming kind of like the ideal American girl. So it's really easy to identify through her fashion with this idea of what American girl means. Because a shirt waist in particular is kind of like becoming this all trend, right? All around trend. Everybody's wearing it. And it crosses races, it crosses classes, it crosses regions. It really is becoming kind of like the thing you wear. And people are kind of like starting to identify the Gibson girl, which is kind of like an imaginary figure, with the girls that they see on the streets, because everybody looks like a Gibson girl. So that imagery is very much kind of like feeding one another. So the Gibson girl, as an illustration, is a very commercialized image, but the fashion industry also kind of like taking on this popularity and marketing shirt waist as Gibson waist, or this is a Gibson skirt, this is a Gibson, right? Because that name sells. So there is this new connection between feminism and fashion and commercialization that happening that allows women to take those ideas and kind of like literally wear them on the body, right? By using and using this image to advance their own agendas, whether so for working class women, they're using the shirtwaist as a way to, and that most of them, that's what they're doing. They're sewing shirtwaist, but they're making that connection that like, look, we also have the right to be Gibson girls and to, you know, be able to have fun and to go out and ride a bicycle. And we have, and by wearing the shirt waist is a way of for them to say we deserve our right both as women, but also as workers. For African American women, for example, this connotation with college culture, with more middle-class respectability, allows them, again, to make claims for racial equality and for inclusion in this American culture by saying, here, look at us. We are also Gibson girls. So they might not necessarily take on the term, but they will definitely take on the fashion. And they look like Gibson girls. So they're Black Gibson girls. And that allows them to say, here, look at us. We're also respectable ladies. And so we deserve rights. So it's this fashion that allows for some kind of cross-class and cross-race solidarity that really unites them and creates this new idea of womanhood that comes and challenges the more kind of like a fragile, docile notion of the true woman that really was kind of like her goal was to become a mother and to kind of like stay at home. But these women are going out in the world and, you know, trying to make their own lives.
But and you like throughout the book, you sort of look at the importance of fashion in class and race as well, and how at these moments that you've chosen or these events that you've chosen, really, even if we have not previously thought about or looked at it, that they really do push for racial equality and class equality in some very important ways.
Yes. And one of the things that enables them to do that is the fact that there is this rise of this new mass culture and mass industry that allows more people to to participate in the fashion world in ways that were not available to them before. When we think about fashion, when we go, you know, to museums and to, we think about those, right, very luxurious dresses by Worth, and that were only available to really the very rich. You know, buying a dress, laundering a dress, right, was something that we don't think about it now, but it's actually a lot of work. And so only the rich can were able to kind of like participate in changing fashions, because they were able to go and buy and to wear, you know, more than one dress a day or a week or a month. But suddenly, with the rise of the industry, you can be fashionable without investing these sums of money, without needing to go to Paris to buy, you know, to buy the dresses in the fashion, because the shirtwaist was this ready-made item that, you know, you can add some lace to it or some embroidery or something like that. And they were relatively cheap. I mean, you could buy, they were in very different qualities. So like a shirtwaist that a middle-class woman would buy or get made was not in the same quality that a working-class woman would have. But the style was very similar. So even if there was a lot of turnout with those shirts, you could look fashionable without investing a lot of sum of money. And that was allow women who were previously prohibited from participating in this fashion world to be part of it and to have a say in it and to say, here, look, we are also kind of like participating in this. We also have a say in this. And that enabled, and because we all wear clothes, right? That enabled kind of like these women roots for their activism in ways that were not open to them. You know, they couldn't vote. They couldn't, most of them were barred from positions of power. But by being able to buy this shirtwaist that looks like, maybe it's not, you know, in the best quality, but it looks like the one who this very rich lady wears, you can start to make kind of like argument, well, I'm part of it too. And so I also entitled to the rights that this rich lady has.
And so, like, we've got this sort of Gibson girl, this rides, you know, this fashion. And then your next chapter moves into this, to the women's rights movement, right? And some of the things we think about often, like wearing white and that, but also other issues and other ways in which fashion was really important to sort of this feminist ideology. So can you talk a little bit about that and what you found in that movement?
Sure. So again, as I said, feminists in the 20th century are younger, are kind of like, most of them are young women. Kind of like the old generation is dying out, and as young women, they're into fashion, right? Because that's what young people do. But they're really, and as I said, the bloomer is really a trauma to some degree in the movement, and they kind of like, and they really understand that they need to sell suffrage, right? They need to convince men to pass this amendment. And in order to do that, they need to be appealing. They need to sell it. And it's not just about what they're saying. It's also about what they look like. And they need to kind of like, you know, to be appealing to the men that they're trying to convince. And they're very kind of like, they're very savvy about it. I mean, they really implement a lot of the things that now we think are kind of like, oh yeah, of course, political campaigns runs like that. But they were actually the first one who really understand kind of like the power of images and advertising and in political campaigns. And they really makes it part of their message. And it's not only kind of like, right, the use of colors and kind of like understanding that, right, our images is going to be in the press. So we need to kind of like create this very visual, appealing images, which you can do with white dresses or very bright dresses, because most of the pictures are black and white. So that contrast worked well for them. There are other reasons they're choosing white, but there are also taking kind of like the mainstream styles. And part of their arguments is that not only that suffrage is not going to masculinize women, right? Because here we are, so beautiful women, up to the trends. We're kind of like, we bring this fashionable taste to politics. But another thing that they kind of like emphasize is that by following fashion, they're not just following fashions, right? They're not just doing what the designers say. They have like, they're cultivating their own sense of style, their own sense of fashion. And that is really an indicative to what they will do with the vote. They're not just going to vote whatever people tell them to do, but the way they cultivate their own style, that's how they're going to cultivate, you know, their decision in to vote. So it helps them to kind of like convince people, look, we are kind of like good citizens. We can bring this, you know, fashion and order and style into politics, while still maintaining kind of like our independence of mind. The way we choose our dresses, that's the way we're going to choose our politicians. So fashion really becomes an important tool for the suffragists. But they really are kind of like, you know, but they're also thinking about, they need to march in streets, right? So they need dresses that can actually enable that. So skirts getting shorter a little, you know, they're mid-calf. It's maybe not our definition of short, but they are shorter. The circumference of the dress is lighter and narrower. So they have pockets, which will become kind of like a very big feminist statement to have pockets in your dress, because pockets say that, you know, this dress is functional and it's not just for beauty. So all those little things are also kind of like, yes, that's what they're enabled them to march in city streets that are often dirty and, you know, really gross, right? So that's kind of like a functional way, but it's also a way for them to show, here, look, we're not going against fashion. We're actually are kind of like showing you what a good voter can look like. And it works. I mean, the press is really supporting them. They're kind of like saying, here, yes, this new generation of suffragists, they're not like their mothers. They look good. They, you know, they're very attractive women. And maybe we should give them the vote because they know what they're doing.
Yeah, I appreciated like reading the pockets. I laughed because we still are arguing, right? Women are still like, these fake pockets or the non, like, we need pockets. We still need pockets. So I was kind of like, yes, they're still making these similar arguments about like what we need in women's fashion. And I thought it was interesting too, like you talk about the shorter skirts or being able to march. And some of the argument is that for health reasons, right? We need it. So it's like also thinking a lot about how fashion can impact health and wellness, right? Also, you know, with the bicycle girls and all of that, but also with like, we can't march, we're going to get sick. This, you know, the clothing is going to literally make us sick. So that's really interesting too, in thinking about.
Yeah. And, you know, and at this point of time, it's also kind of like shifting from corsets to bras, and bras did, you know, I know it sounds weird for 21st century, but bras were an improvement and were looked at as a kind of like a more liberating item than corsets. But part of the reason was, right, like before we argue for, you know, political equality, we need to breathe. We need to be able to walk. We need pockets. Like that's kind of like the fundamentals before we can even imagine on kind of like to think about more philosophical or more kind of like, you know, abstract rights, like voting. Like, we need to be able to walk and breathe. And so clothes do become kind of like more convenient, more comfortable. Partly, as I said, like, it's not just because the industry do look for consumers. So the industry kind of like becoming some form of an ally in that regard, because for them, it's kind of like, okay, if all these women are going to buy these dresses with pockets, we might as well want to make dresses with pockets, right? But the industry wants to make money, and the industry goes along with this simplifications of fashion because it's cheaper to make. It's much more easier to standardize according to sizes. So kind of like what once we kind of like moved to the 20s, and the flapper fashions and that are more kind of like really rectangular and very simple in look, it is also like the industry embraces it because it's cheaper to make. So it's easier to make and they can do it. So it's not like that, you know, there are some people in like a room of the fashion industry that decide, yeah, let's be feminist. This is not happening because of that. But there is consumer pressure that aligns with also other interests of the industry that they say, yeah, that's kind of like, yeah, we can do that. And women take advantage of that. To some degree. And when the industry tries to push something that they don't like, women pushes back. I mean, and as you said, we're still fighting for pockets. So.
Well, and that pushback, like you mentioned, like your next chapter is sort of on the flappers, and which is kind of also, I think, often becomes like the focal point of sort of American fashion. But you talk a lot about how like this movement in the 20s, for various reasons, there was a lot of pushback by especially younger women about what we're going to wear or what we're not going to wear. So could you talk a little bit about that, the flappers and some of that pushback?
Yeah. So again, you know, by the 20s and those changes, you know, they're not like everybody waking up in January 1st, 1920 and moving into flapper dresses. I mean, changes are happening, you know, starting with the war, where, you know, with women mobilization to the war. And again, this need to make them uniform, to make a clothes that will be utilitarian, that will be functional. So that kind of like pushes on and the flapper, and again, like these women have the vote now. It's the young generation, this rise of new youth culture that's saying, yeah, I'm going to do whatever I want, right? I'm not going to listen to my parents anymore. This world has died in the war to some degree. So they're starting to push back, these fashions are youthful. There is this cult of youth, and that, you know, who doesn't want to look younger, right? So a lot of older women also kind of like joining this, and those changes, I mean, they do sometimes feel overnight because once you, get rid of your undergarments and wearing this very light clothes all of a sudden and then cut your hair, you often lose, 10 pounds overnight. That's a big change, you know, to wake up minus 10 pounds and then walk in the world. It's a different experience. So the change was kind of like for the individual woman, very sudden, right? Once you cut your hair. But if you look at it, it is kind of like this, more gradual that begins, in the mid teens by these radical feminists, who kind of like more bohemian and more kind of like on the fringes of the society. But by the 20s, those fashion becomes the mainstream, the industry adopts them. And the industry, again, kind of like, hey, we can sell that. And women do embrace it. But the industry needs change to survive. That's how the fashion industry works. But women says, no, like this works for me. Like I'm good. Like that's let's stay with these fashions. These are great for us. And the industry's like, wait a minute. Like we need to really convince people to buy new clothes, because otherwise, like, what are we doing? Right. So the industry in the end of the decade do try to push for longer skirts, and they get a lot of pushback from women and from feminists who really interpret it as this attack on their freedoms, not just their kind of like what skirts I can wear, but also their political freedoms, their right to vote. And they and these women really connect, kind of like, we have the right to vote. So why do you think you can tell me kind of like, what should I wear? Like, I'm an independent voter, so I can decide also what to wear. And women really pushed back, and the industry kind of like gives in to some degree. I mean, there is compromise. Clothes for evening wear do get longer at the end of the decade, but short skirts survive. And this idea that, you know, that clothes need to serve the person who wears it and not vice versa, that idea really survives. And, you know, and the Depression also helps, you know, people buy just less clothes during the Depression. It's not the most urgent thing, right, to renew your wardrobe. So that kind of like prolongs the fashions also a little. But this idea of kind of like, yes, that women are not going to take, you know, designer's decree anymore, just because they're coming from Paris or just because the industry pushes the style, like we're going to do it because it works for us. And that idea really stays throughout the 20th century, even kind of like longer, even if the fashion themselves changes.
Yeah, I appreciate you have, I mean, there's illustrations throughout the book, right? But one of the ones I really loved was you have one with the chain in this chapter, the changing of the flapper girl skirts. So it's like for 10, right? Because we do often think like fashion's going to happen quickly, but it kind of shows how it sort of changes in these increments over the years and goes up and down,
right?
And kind of moves around, which is great. And also with the flap, like, you also talk a lot about how African American women use sort of this idea of the flapper girl to sort of make some political and social statements as well. So could you talk a little bit about that too?
Sure. So yeah, I mean, flappers, black flappers and white flappers, right, or other women of color are really kind of like buying into this new promises of this new youth culture, right? We have cars and we have movie theaters and all those fun stuff when we think about roaring 20s. And again, this availability of those styles to much more to these larger populations enabled African American to also claim that image, to say, hey, we're flapper too. We're also entitled to be part of this youth culture. And to be as equal in that. And it's also a moment when a lot of young African-American women are moving to the North, right? And they're moving by themselves as part of this great migration. So it's a way for them to kind of like cultivate this, you know, their own identity, their own modern identity. They're oftentimes single. They're not always kind of like under the supervising eye of a mother or the church or their employer. And the fashion is a way for them to participate in this new youth culture that they want to be part of. And they think it's part, you know, their right to be part of, right? But because of those racist stereotypes that they need to be careful, they need to maintain this notion that there are respectable girls, that they are not promiscuous, that they are not There is this tension. So they kind of like their challenge is both kind of like vis-a-vis the white society and saying, yes, we like this is racial equality and we're, you know, we black flappers are just the same as white flappers. But it also against kind of like more the elders and more conservative forces in the black community that say, well, maybe you shouldn't wear such short skirts. Maybe you shouldn't wear, you know, such revealing clothes. And they say, no, we have the right to do it. That doesn't make us promiscuous. That doesn't make us, you know, not good girls, right? We can wear what we want and be in fashion and be part and be equal to our white peers without kind of like threatening the community itself. So they have kind of like a more delicate negotiation, both within their own communities, but and outside in their kind of like using this fashion to kind of, but to claim their own, they're kind of like, yes, we have the right to do it, right? And that's part of kind of like what it means to be a modern woman, to be an independent woman. So I think for them, it's, and again, it's part of kind of like being in this youth culture that really challenges the older generation. And in communities of immigrants, it's oftentimes also kind of like brings all kind of debates between parents who are like, are less comfortable with that culture. But young women saying, no, that's part of being an American. We're part of this American culture and we want to stay in it.
And so another thing that you look at throughout, but then you really focus on in one chapter is sort of like design and the designers. And it's always interesting to be reminded, like, I think it might've been in chapter three, but you talk about Lane Bryant, right? And like Lane Bryant was a person, you know, and not just like a line of clothing, but this idea of like who these designers were and sort of using that in politics, and that small p politics. But so can you talk a little bit about what you were seeing with sort of the power of design and sort of the sort of professional like fashion networks?
Yeah. So the beginning of the 20th century, or even up until the mid 20th century, the fashion industry is a very welcoming place for women. And it's a place where women can really have a say. Both because, you know, it seems like, oh, women are kind of like better at that. They have a better sense of style. They know what women want. And it's not like a threatening branch of the industry so much. It's not like they're taking away males' power to some degree. I mean, they do take, but kind of like it seemed like it's a better thing to do that than in like the car industry, right? And so it's a place for them to get more easily into positions of power. The 20s are kind of like the height of women's designers. You know, we all think about Coco Chanel, you thought, you know, Lane Bryant, right? All those people who used to be people, right? that are now kind of like big corporations. But part of the reason is that you don't need a lot of money to start a couture business or to start designing clothes. You just need a sewing machine. Basically. So it's a route for women to gain economic independence in a way that is easier for them than to kind of like start a business, right? So women are really beginning to get into that industry. And because the American industry is very much based on wholesale and retail and not so much on couture design, that's kind of like the Paris, right? Even though that even in Paris, it's kind of like women are becoming the main designers of this period. But retail design, they're fairly anonymous up until the 30s and 40s. Nobody knows who designed, like, you know, you often, right, you don't know who designed the clothes for H&M. Like, you just go to the store and buy it. So it's easier for them, both for white women, but also for African-American women, because nobody knows who's designing it. So employers are more kind of like willing to hire these people to work in those industries. But by the 30s, and again, the Great Depression, there's an economic need for to convince women to buy clothes. And Dorothy Shaver from Lord & Taylor, she's and the newly vice president of Lord & Taylor. And again, like, she's a woman and she's becoming this very high position in the company. And she comes up with this idea, look, we need to push kind of like to convince women to buy clothes. So she started this campaign, American Fashion for American Women, kind of like starting this idea of like, look, buy domestic design, because that's the patriotic way thing to do, right? To help the economy, to like, this is what you can do to save our country, right? To buy new clothes. And in her campaign, she really started to publicize the names of the designers and kind of like really making them a celebrity to some degree, and to say, hey, look, right, Paris is always kind of like in the background, and Paris was always the source of styles. But by the 30s, there is kind of like more looking inward, because it's expensive to go to Paris, it's expensive to get, you know, to buy a licensed. We're starting to get into copyrights issues. So it's much easier for the industry to rely on domestic design. But you need to convince women who were told all their lives that, you know, only Paris can manufacture fashions. Why is it better to buy American design? And by World War II, this becomes a necessity, because Paris, you know, once Paris falls into the Nazis' regime, that's it. Like, there's no connection with Paris anymore. And the industry is basically on its own. So there is this push, and mainly for kind of like this idea of like, these are clothes that are made by women for women, because women knows what the American woman needs. And it is, again, this idea of comfort, this idea of like this woman on the go that needs kind of like comfortable clothing that, and really the 40s is where we get all those, you know, the things that were still with us today, you know, leotards, ballet flats, zippers, belts, all those tiny things. Layering is another concept that is being introduced in the 40s, that kind of like, if you're out and about all day, you need, you know, your clothes to be suited for the weather that might change. Or you need to pack kind of like, you know, this versatile wardrobe that in 7 items, you can have like an entire combination of wardrobe. So all those concepts that are very much connected to the reality of depression and war are also connected to this idea that we need to find design language that will really sell this idea of freedom, this idea of movement, this idea of functionality, because that's what women want. And we need to design not to this ideal woman that French designers thinks that this is the woman, but to the real American women who, you know, works in factories or need to go to get a job or raising children or hosting dinners in their homes. These are the real women that we design for, and we need clothes that will suit for them.
Yes, I love that. Even though we think it's like, you know, this new thing, like sportswear and leisure wear, it's like what we've always wanted. And then someone tells you you want something else, and then leisure wear costs like tons of money after, right? Now we have Lululemon, right? Like, yes, but like we've always wanted leisure wear.
Right. It's not just in the pandemic that we started to wear leggings. It's like,
it's always been. Yeah, and you know, and one other thing, I mean, this is not the leisure word, but another thing that I thought like throughout this is kind of interesting is like all the ways in which different spaces in society are always attempting to police women and women's fashion, right? It makes me think of the continued debate about girls, especially young girls in school, and because it's usually about what girls should and should not wear, right? But there is this sort of theme throughout a lot of this, and thinking as we move into your final chapter on sort of the women's rights movement about this policing of women's, what women can and cannot wear and why they should and should not wear certain things.
Right. And women are pushing back against that. And for them, you know, right, the ability to say, no, this is what I want to wear. And I don't care what, you know, other people say, and I'm not willing to be policed. That's for them not less important than be able to vote or equal pay for equal right. Right. It's about like, I want to appear in public in the way that I think is fit for me. And not the way, you know, my parents, my community leaders, my, you know, city hall sometimes, right? We have in the 20s, all kind of city ordinance that are regulating women bathing suits and kind of like the cover of my book is like a picture of a policeman kind of like measuring the space between the bathing suit and the knee. And all of these women are kind of like really understanding that fashion does become kind of like a political arena, right? That it's what they wear is oftentimes a cover up for kind of like what they can do in public or what they can say in public. So kind of like that's kind of like the first line of defense, right? Like if we can choose what we wear and how do we appear in public, kind of like you cannot tell us also the other things that are might more important. But it's a way for them to kind of like really understand that this is not just about kind of like what's in fashion. This is really kind of like where politics are being played out.
Right. And that sort of moves us into those like that 1960s and 70s, right? This the myth of the bra burner, right? And this idea of what is it like women's lib and fashion and what that means. And you title that chapter, "This is what a feminist looks like," which I think is we still are talking about that. So can you talk a little bit about what fashion-wise was going on in the 70s that was really important?
Yeah, and I think, you know, it is important to remind people that, yeah, no bras were ever burned. in that very famous demonstration against Miss America. But again, this notion of choice is really becoming central to feminism in the 60s and 70s. And it's, you know, it's reproductive choice. There's a lot of choice, right? But it's also the choice of how you present yourself. And again, there's certainly gendered critique, and there's certainly feminists who think like, no, we should not just abide to this fashion industry that oftentimes, you know, objectified women, sexualized them. So we don't need to play to that, you know, things. And they do try to kind of like devise their own style of what does it mean to be a feminist and what does it mean to be a woman. And for some, it means to wear jeans and to, you know, to not highlight their feminine traits. You know, lesbian feminists are kind of like going into this dyke fashion as they describe it, that are more kind of like button down shirts, jeans, but not all feminists subscribe to it. And not all feminists think that, you know, we need like that we need to give up so easily the fun of dressing up. And for some feminists, you know, the miniskirt, which is very hyper sexualized item, but they can celebrate their sexuality without, you know, give a F, without everybody, that's part of their sexual liberation. So there is this debate about kind of like how you can use clothes, but not a lot of feminists, and that's kind of like I think the myth goes, think that, oh, we should kind of like end the discussion and kind of like this is only kind of like distracts us from, you know, the important stuff that we're fighting for. No, for a lot of feminists, this is part of this personal is political, right? The way you dress is very personal, and it can be and was a political statement. So there's a lot of thinking about what should be the feminist style and what should be kind of like, what should we wear to kind of that will align with our politics, and a lot of the intra-debates within feminists. Black feminists are not so, you know, eager to give up claims of femininity. They're kind of like, oh, you might kind of like be happy, you know, wearing jeans and, you know, making yourself ugly, but like, you know, we don't get any liberation. Black women don't get any liberation from that because that's what we had our entire lives. So there is this debate within the feminist movement of kind of like how should we present ourselves? And this notion that we need to be able to choose, that's the most important thing, that it's the choice, right? That, you know, that we don't need policing, whether it's from other feminists or from the society at large. And that's that women could be able to choose whether it's a miniskirt, whether it's pants, right? And those are becoming kind of like the fight. So on the one hand, there is this fight of maintaining the mini when the industry pushes for, again, longer length as a way to kind of like get more money. And women pushes back against the mini, and they say, no, like we want to keep the mini. But some women are like saying, no, we want to be able to wear pants to work. And that should not get us fired. So there is this constant thinking of, there's not a rejection of fashion as more as kind of like, how can we make a fashion works for us and kind of like be aligned with our political values and the political messages that we want to convey. So it actually kind of like much more powerful tool than to just burn your bra.
Yes, right. And we think about, most retired, but there are women who've retired from my university who are still alive, who have told the story of when they finally got to wear pants to work. Right. And that is a big deal. And so so I think we often think about fashion as like the couture, like France, you know, like these kind of like, we're going to look to Paris or Milan or wherever, but like getting to wear pants to work is a political statement, is a fashion statement. And if they have pockets, it's even better.
Right. Yeah. I mean, even in places, and again, kind of like only in 1993, which is not so long ago, women were allowed to wear pants to Congress on Congress floor, right? We think like now when we see Kamala Harris, right, or you know, Hillary Clinton, who made the pantsuit her own trademark, this is kind of like, oh, this is how women politicians wear, right? That's how women lawyers wear. But no, it was a very big struggle for them to get to that point. And 1990s is like, it's not a long time ago.
You have your epilogue sort of gets at that, like that idea of like that fashion is still sort of challenging and pushing and making impact. And even within the you talk about even within the feminist movement itself. So you want to, I don't know if you have anything you want to talk about with where you see fashion going or like how you kind of see fashion impacting feminism even now and today.
I think fashion is still kind of like something that we're certainly aware of, and you know, and the last 2 years, if anything, right, have changed drastically the way we wear what we wear. You know, all of us moved to leggings and loungewear for a while. There's a big question: where women ever be back to the bra? I mean, I think they will, but unfortunately, but again, it will look differently just because suddenly, right, we got like everybody sitting from home. It's like, why should I buy nice clothes? Like, where should I have to go out, right, anymore? So I do think we're going to see some changes in the way we wear, the way we dress. But also, I think political movements that we have now and political struggles are also kind of like understanding kind of like that, yeah, images do work. And how do we think about images? So we think, you know, now that our masks are becoming kind of like this, right, this political canvas, you can write your message on the mask. And I think that has become really a political use that we see lately. We see women politicians really working the fashion card really well in Congress. Maybe not everybody likes that. But I think, you know, people like AOC, like Kristen Sinema, they really understand, look, fashion is part of our tools, right? And if we're going to be judged on how we look, so let's use it to our favor. So that's part of kind of like their political strategy. And it also, you know, also men, right? Raphael Warnock, Adams from New York City. There are men who really kind of like doing interesting thing with fashion. And I think people are kind of like more, are used to kind of like, because we think about fashion, it's such an individual choice, an individual expression of our identity. People understand that it's important, right? That that it is political. So, you know, I'm better at what happened than to foresee the future. But I do think that the pandemic really made us rethink kind of like what do we wear and how do we present ourselves, that we're going to see changes.
So we've been talking for a while, I could probably talk to you about fashion for longer, but my final question is always, if you have anything else either you're working on or anything with, I know the book is, does it just come out or, right? So if there's anything that you're doing with promotion with the book, so if there's any last sort of shout out you want to, you know, talk about.
Yeah, so the book is available in the shops or where you buy your books, either through Amazon or to the press, Illinois Press. And yes, there are some events coming up where I talk about the book. The question, how many of them are going to be? I was like kind of like looking forward for it to be in person, but I think now some of them are going to be online. So you can check my website, which is www.anavrabinovichfox.com. It's one word and it's a long word. But for future events and links for more online or remote events, at least. But yeah, and, you know, and fashion is part of our, I think, everyday life. So that's, and I think that's part of kind of like what I was trying to get in the book, that we really need to think about it as an everyday feminist practice, right? And that feminism happening not just through organizing or not just through official movements, but also kind of like in the everyday life of people. So, you know, next time you get dressed in the morning, think about what you want to say to the world.
It has been wonderful talking with you again, Einav Rabinovich-Fox, who is the author of Dressed for Freedom, The Fashionable Politics of American Feminism. Thanks for talking with me.
Thank you.